Good evening. I'm Cindy from Santa Barbara. I'm very grateful to be here this evening. Robin called me and asked me if I would come and speak. She's very sick and she sends her regards. I know a lot of you know her and she has 33 years. You'll have to accept me. I have 28 coming up. My sobriety date is 1/1/89, so almost 28, hopefully, soon. I'd like to thank Kristen for asking me and accepting me. I want to thank Robin for calling me and Will for coming to support me. I have some sponsees, but it was short notice, so I didn't ask them. One of them is very sick. She has cancer, so I didn't think it was appropriate for me to ask her anyway. Let's see. I guess I will start with my family of origin was, all I can say about them is that they didn't learn from their childhood how to love. And so they didn't know how to show love. My father was a colonel in the Air Force, and my mother was raised by her grandmother because her father was a prohibition officer, really did not want her. And it was this family where there was just not a lot of cuddling, or I never heard I love you, I never got a kiss. And later on, my mom and I really worked on that because we did go to counseling during this last 10 years. I had a step-parent who, when my mom and dad did divorce, who was really inappropriate with me. And it was the first time that I learned that if I acted in a way that was sexual, that meant someone loved me. And it was such a strange twist right away when I was little for me to learn that. In school, I was really introverted, went to Catholic school, and everything was a secret because it was a secret at home, so there were lots of secrets. The place that I felt really fulfilled was in sports. And I was a tomboy, and I played baseball. I had three brothers, and I still play ball. I play senior tournament softball, and I play on a sober team. And so it's still a big part of my story. When I was in high school, I remember going to my reunion and people saying, "Did you really come to this high school?" And I went, "Yeah, I really was. I really did." Not one single person recognized me. And it was because I sat in the stairwell for 4 years. And that was how I got through high school. Once I met someone, had sex, I once again, that trigger went off, sex is love. And it wasn't. It was not. But I got pregnant at 17, had my son, took him on the back of my bike to school, and that's how it was. I stayed living at home. I still had not discovered drugs and alcohol, but very soon after that, as soon as I graduated from high school and I found alcohol and drugs, I recognized this was it. Like, this is where I could feel like I felt a part of. That was how I felt a part of when I would get loaded. I just felt like it was liquid courage for me. I felt like it allowed me to fit in, something that I had never felt before. But I still had that thing in my head about sex is love, and I wanted love. And so I went to work for some crazy, sleazy magazines in the San Fernando Valley. And you can't be in that line of work and not be loaded. You cannot do that kind of work and not be high and drunk. You just can't. And so that was what I did. I drank, I used drugs, and I got into that road of pornography. And somehow or another, I stayed in school. I stayed in school and I graduated from college, and I lived this double life. This we got a call from Larry Flint from Hustler magazine, said, "You want to come to work for us?" I said, "Hell yeah." So off I went to Ohio with my husband, who was writing pornography. And so he wrote pornography, and I managed their softball team. We were called the Hustler Beavers. Of course, you know, we were in scantily clad clothing, and, you know, once again, it was we'd get loaded and drink and play ball. And that was where I felt at home, was sports and sex and drugs and alcohol. So it was all good for a while. But people started getting sick because AIDS came, right? And our friends started dying. And my husband got sick. And we didn't know if it was AIDS related or if it was just cancer. But we knew that, for one thing, it was unsafe for us in Columbus, Ohio, with that magazine, because it was very conservative there. So they moved the magazine back to LA, and my husband continued to get sicker, and I lived in an open marriage, and so he basically had three wives, and we were all there. And when it came time for him to die, he decided that he wanted to be with the woman that he really loved. I was married to him, but his soulmate was one of the other women. And I had to let that go. And it was one of the hardest times, and I was drinking a lot not to feel that. And that was always why I drank, was not to feel. It was always why I drank. And it was not to feel scared, not to feel nervous, not to feel whatever I was feeling at the time, because I didn't want to. And he passed away, and very soon after that, of course, I hooked up with someone right away. And by this time, I was teaching. And as a matter of fact, in Ohio, I was teaching at a Christian school and working for Larry Flint. It was really, really bizarre. And so I had this double life for a long time. And I was teaching in back in Los Angeles at the time. Met a musician, a studio musician in LA, and of course, he was fully into drugs and alcohol. And so right down that road I went. Boy, was I happy, really content, found someone that was just gonna just go the road with me. But my little boy was being dragged along. And I always thought, oh, I'm a good mom, I'm a good mom. Well, good moms do not have their child for 8 hours standing with the cocaine in their hands ready to flush it while you're at the window looking out going, "I know they're coming any minute, honey." No, good moms do not do that. And I do need to remember those times. But I did that. And my drug use, my alcohol use skyrocketed. And I don't remember a time that I left the house without having at least a half pint of tequila in my purse. I was riding a motorcycle, and I would carry that half pint in the bottom, the seat of my motorcycle. And the violence during that relationship and the turmoil and the insane behavior, all of those things that go with alcohol, they were there. And the things I did, I remember once I started getting loaded in Santa Barbara and I woke up in Mexico. And another time I was in Mexico on a surf trip, and I woke up in the morning to the Federales knocking on the van window, and I was stuck to my tequila sunrise on the floor. And I woke up and went, "Oh my God, my son, where's my son?" He was at the campsite. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I never want to forget those. I never want to forget those. And maybe that's the reason that relapse isn't part of my story, because I'm too scared to go back out there. I'm too scared to have that again. Oh, gosh. And another time I was out on a boat and I woke up and there's two dudes. It's in the middle of the night. We're in the middle of the ocean on the way to Catalina. I have no idea who they are. And I guarantee that the only reason that they did not rape me was because I was so seasick I was covered with vomit. And how attractive is that? But I was attractive like that often. And I remember that was like, I would wake up like that often. And, I never wanted to do that again. And then in December 1988, I remember just taking a hit off of my tequila. And I was on my bike. And I came riding up to the house. And there's my 16-year-old son being taken out in handcuffs. The SWAT team had broken down the door and my boyfriend was being taken out, and what did I do? I stepped on the gas and left him. That's what I did. And I have to live with that. I have to live with that. But that's what I did, and I stayed away for a while, and then I figured out where my son was, and my boyfriend got right into Newhouse. He immediately got sober, and I kept lying, saying, yeah, I'm sober, I'm sober, I'm sober. For about 30 days. And then I realized when I got my letter that said, you need to come down to the police station because you're going to be arrested. And these were felonies. And I was teaching school. I had a California teaching credential. And I was getting loaded in the school bathroom. And oh my gosh, I was just a mess. But I knew that it was over. I knew it was over. And I went to a meeting. I walked into a meeting after about 30 days of just that lying. And I heard a woman from the podium share. And I recognized that was me. Not everything, but there were similarities. There were enough similarities that I said, I think I might really have a problem. And I kept coming. I just kept coming. And I didn't know in the beginning if it was going to be enough to just go to meetings. And for a while, I just went to meetings and held on. And I finally got a sponsor. And oh, what a wonderful woman. She had done so many of the things I had done and been to so many of the places that I had been, and I related to her. And I could tell her the truth, which is something that I didn't do a lot of when I was out there. By the end, I was smoking crack cocaine in the school bathroom. That's how bad it got. AA has been a huge focus for me. Having a sponsor and working the steps and really having a God in my life and trusting that it was going to turn out. But even though AA was my main focus, that man who I lived with for those years, that musician, he kept coming back into my life. He had moved off to Australia, thinking a geographic was going to work, and we know how that works. Wherever we go, there we are. And he was. And he kept coming back, and I adored him. I loved him so much. And of course, I always embraced him to come back and try and get clean. And one year he came back and said, hey, Sin, I need to tell you something. And I said, what is it? And he said, I've met someone. And I said, really? And he said, and we're going to have a baby. And I said, oh, my God. And he said, do you think I should marry her? And I said, do you love her? And he said, yeah. And I said, then you need to go and marry her. And you did. But he kept coming back. And my heart still had that little opening, right? That little opening. Until the very last time. And somehow, one more time, I had that moment of clarity. Like I did when I walked into that first meeting. I had it, and I realized I couldn't do it anymore. I could not do it anymore. This man was now married. He had a child. I couldn't do it. And so I said, no, you can't stay with me. And so he stayed at my son's house, and at Christmas, he didn't call his wife, and he didn't call his children, and he was shooting heroin. And I told him how self-centered he was and how cruel that was. And off he went, and 3 days later, he was dead. And on my 6-year sober birthday, I had to bury him. And I had to make that call to her. And I still embrace her. And that son he had came and lived with me here in the United States for a year. And so there's been a lot of healing around that. I wanted that day to get loaded and drunk so badly. I can't even tell you. It was one of those days that you do not ever want to feel. But guess what? I reached out. I called my sponsor. I called the women in my group. I called people, and they were there. And they showed up, and they were there at that funeral, and they came for me. They didn't know him, but they came for me. I jumped back into the steps. I knew that God was the only answer. God, you know that good, orderly direction? I started taking it again. I started working the steps again. I had been doing jail work for 9 years of my sobriety, my early sobriety. I really was involved in H&I. But when that happened, for a moment I pulled away. And then I realized, this is the only salvation I have. It's the only way. Because I'll be buried if I take the other road. And that was not my choice anymore. It was not my choice anymore. I sponsor women, 3 of them. I generally do not sponsor more than 3, although I have. And those are the women I called. It's something that is embedded in me now, that the moment there is crisis, I reach out. I reach out to others. After that happened, I met someone in the program, much younger, like a son, younger than my son, who was dying. His name is Bo. And Bo was in a hospital in Los Angeles. And I had started a softball team, a women's softball team there called Higher Powered. And then I played on another team called Spiritual Purpose, and then another called Came to Believe. And the guys from Came to Believe, it was a men's team. I played on the men's forever. and they asked if I wanted to go visit this kid in L.A. And I said, yeah, I'll go visit him, absolutely. And so we went, and I met Bo, and I hardly knew Bo. But every week we would drive down, and eventually the guys got tired of driving down, but I kept going. And he and I talked for hours, and he was at USC Medical Center. So it was a long way, but it was so worth it. And he was coming back to Santa Barbara, and he would be in the hospital in Santa Barbara, but by now, his dad had also gotten cancer and was dying. And so the family could not take care of both of them. And when he came back to Santa Barbara, I made a commitment to go 3 nights a week to the hospital and sit with Bo and talk with him until he fell asleep. And I did that. And then he said, Sin, I do not want to die in the hospital. And I said, well, sweetheart, let's just get a house. And I have the summer off. I'll take you home and I'll stay with you till you die. Like it's like, oh, what did you do on your summer vacation? Well, that's what I did. And we got a little house, and I left my house, and I told my son, take care of my cat. I'm moving in with Bo. And I slept on a mattress next to his bed, And it turned out I slept on that mattress for 8 months until he died. And it was the best, I tell you, it was some of the best 8 months I've ever had, because his group, he was in an AA group and another fellowship, and they really abandoned him. They didn't see him, and he was the addict still suffering. But I called AA, and I said, hey, this was to Tim W. from Santa Barbara, and I said, Tim, you think you can get some people to come to our house because we can't get out anymore? And he said, I'll make it happen. And every Wednesday night, they would bring a group of people in around this hospital bed to share the AA story and to share what was going on and to listen to Bo and to listen to me and to let me talk and say how we were feeling. And even on that last night before Bo left, they came. And we all said our goodbyes. And we know that he heard us. Even though he couldn't speak anymore, we know that he heard us. And the next morning, I remember saying to him, sweetheart, the bus is here. If you have to leave before I get home from school, it's okay. And he did, 10 minutes before I got home from school. Because he knew I was not going to be able to handle it. And I was so mad because Bo weighed like 500 pounds. He was a massive man. And I told them, you cannot fit him in a body bag. Please do not bring a body bag. Bring sheets or cloths. And I said, and bring lots of people because it will take you a lot of people to move him. But they tried to get him in that body bag, and it was so irritating that they did that I smoked a cigarette. And it was like, okay, if I'm going to have a relapse on anything, it must be a damn cigarette. And it was. But at least it was only a cigarette. And that was the last cigarette. I haven't had any again since then in all these years. I don't know, no matter how much time you have in the program, you don't always make perfect choices. Having that cigarette, that was not the perfect choice. I was dating someone at the time Bo was dying, and it was someone who was my son's age, and I married him. And it was good for a minute, you know. But he left for someone younger. And our paths grew apart, and he didn't stay sober. And he's back in AA now, and I'm very grateful he is. He really needs to be. But, you know, it was one of those choices. It was just one of those choices. I've always liked younger guys, and so that was a problem when I was teaching high school. At 23. And so that has always been something that I've really kind of had to work on. And I'm really grateful now I'm dating someone my own age. But you know, we make mistakes, we learn from them, right? Everything is a teacher. I have constantly recommitted to the program when I've made those kinds of big mistakes, and that was one of them. It was very hard being left for someone else, especially someone 30 years younger. I love the program because I can always look at myself. And I can always say to myself, okay, what was your part in that? And there's always a part. There's never a time when it is always the other person's fault, ever. And what is it that that person has taught me out of that? That's what I need to look at. I retired in 2010, and I'm rather spontaneous. And so I called my son, and I said, I just want to let you know that I'm moving to Costa Rica. And he said, when? And I said, in 2 weeks. And I did. And it was a fantastic experience because AA is everywhere. It's everywhere. I went down there. I immediately got girls to sponsor. I immediately got a sponsor. I really connected right away, and I got into a routine because for me, I need that. I need routine. I need structure in my life. If I don't have it, I'm screwed. And so that was very, very, very big growth for me, going and living in the rainforest by myself, going to meetings, speaking at conventions, being one of the people that had the most time at a convention. That's unheard of here. You got people with 50 years here at a convention. But there to be one of the three people in the convention that had more than 20 years, that was big. And so for me to be able to go and share my story and give other people hope that they too can walk through things, difficult things, and come out on the other end without using and drinking. That's for me the biggest thing. I still work the steps. And I'm working on step 6 right now with some of my character defects. And certainly, you know, I've worked on these character defects over the years, and at times they've gotten better, and then at times they're just glaring again. And right now they're glaring. Some of the things that I do in recovery now, I play on Came to Believe. It's a co-ed team, and it's a big part of my recovery. Is that I'm accountable to those people. If I'm not there or they haven't heard from me, they're going to be calling me. It's like a home group. It's exactly like having a home group. I have a women's game night once a month, and it's all different women in recovery, and we invite different women to come every month, and we have dinner together, and we socialize. And I think it's really important for us to have fun, even outside of the meetings, you know, to really know that there is a life outside of just coming to meetings. And so I do that. I play senior softball. I'm still playing on a tournament team, and hoping this year to get some new knees so that I can play again because it's getting much more difficult. And I live in pain. And what really the doctors want is for me to be on pain management. And guess what? I am not going pain management. And when the doctors said to me, oh, well, you should just quit sports, I said, you know, you would not be saying this to me if I was a man. You'd be saying, yeah, let's get those knees fixed and let's get you back out there. And I changed doctors. Someone who believes that being active is important. Because being active is also part of my recovery. Not sitting on my ass, feeling sorry for myself, not doing anything. That's not what I want out of life. I want to be with people who are showing up for life. You guys are showing up for life. And that's what we want to do. That's what we want to do because we don't have drugs and alcohol to alter life anymore. So what better way than to be in the present moment and show up? What I do now is I try to live very much in the moment. I know how quickly it can be over. You've heard from my story, I've had lots of loss. And I recognize that it can be over in just a moment. And so I want to just leave you with this, and I know I'm ending a little early, but in my reading this morning, I was reading about being in the present moment, and it was the reading of the day. And it said, "Only as I am aware of the present will I have the opportunity to live fully. Today I live fully." And I can see that there are many, many other people in this room that live fully. We deserve that. We owe that to ourselves. And we owe it to the next person who walks through these doors asking for recovery. Thank you.